Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Welcome to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange. This hour, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is with us. Clinton's political biography is well known, a former First Lady, U.S. Senator from New York, and Secretary of State. And it's with that long resume in hand that Clinton has been running for the Oval Office for a second time, promoting the idea that, out of all the contenders, she has the experience and background to tackle the challenges of the presidency from day one. But Clinton has faced her own political challenges on the campaign trail, especially that many voters this year seem less interested in experience and more interested in defying the establishment and the mistakes they feel it has made. For the next 40 minutes in The Exchange, we'll talk with Secretary Clinton, and in addition to taking questions from me and Josh Rogers, we'll hear from our live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. They'll be submitting questions as well. And Josh, let's kick it off with you.
Okay, welcome, Secretary Clinton.
Thank you very much.
I think it's fair to say that Senator Bernie Sanders seems to have established what seems like a lead in New Hampshire. It certainly feels like one at the moment. He's also doing fine in Iowa. Nobody expected this when this race began. My question is one that you've probably asked yourself, what's going on?
Well, I always thought it would be a hard campaign. I'm not one who thinks that when you're running for the president, it is ever going to be preordained or easy. There was going to be a contest, and I have the greatest respect for Senator Sanders, and I think that he and I are engaged in a really spirited debate, drawing contrasts between us. I feel very good about the organization and the level of energy and enthusiasm that my supporters are bringing to the forefront here in New Hampshire, just as in Iowa. And I think now, as the issues are more clarified and joined leading up to the primary here, more folks are tuning in. More people are saying, okay, there's a big difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. That is very obvious. And there are a lot of similar concerns that the Democrats are sharing. So who can be president and commander-in-chief? Who can get the economy working for everybody? Who can keep us safe and can make our leadership in the world lead to more peace, prosperity, and security? And who can deal with a lot of the problems that keep folks up at night, whether it's college affordability and debt or prescription drug costs or addiction and mental health? And I think on the whole array of what the next president will have to do, I come prepared and ready to walk into the White House on January 20th, 2017.
Well, one thing that's been interesting in the polling out there is that it shows that most Democrats, certainly most Democrats who are going to be voting in the New Hampshire primary, are comfortable with you on the basis of your credentials. One recent survey found 60% of likely participants in the New Hampshire primary on the Democratic side believe that you have the experience to be president. But polls also show a lot of Democrats, you know, have questions about whether they can trust you. An MUR poll out this week said 55% consider you the least trustworthy in the Democratic field. How do you address something like that?
Well, look, I obviously don't like hearing that, especially because during my entire public and professional life, the people I've worked with, the people who have seen me in action, trust me, count on me. I mean, just think about what it was like for President-elect Obama to turn around and ask me to be Secretary of State after the tough primary that we ran against each other, because he knew he could trust me and he could count on me to work with him to help our country recover some of the ground we lost in the Bush administration. It's why so many of my former colleagues in the Senate and representatives in the House are for me. It's not because I'm some establishment figure. I mean, my goodness, I'm running to be the first woman president of the United States. There's hardly anything more anti-establishment than that. It's because they know me. They know when I say I will do something, I carry through. I work hard to get results for people. So I am aware that there's a lot of incoming political fire that seems to be part of the background in this election when it comes to me. But I feel good that as voters in New Hampshire really start asking themselves the hard questions leading up to the primary, who can actually get things done? We sure don't want more gridlock. I don't think New Hampshire residents want to wait for getting prescription drug costs down or getting paychecks rising and more good jobs being created or dealing with the terrible dilemma posed by the lack of support to go to college. So I think as people are really looking at this, they don't want to start all over. They want to build, if you're a Democrat, on the progress that President Obama has made. That's what I've said I will do, but I want to go further. And I think that's a very good argument because, yes, we all would love to see even greater change happen. I certainly am fed up with the dysfunction. I'm outraged by the amazing amount of influence and money that Citizens United, that the Supreme Court opened the door to. But I think I have a better chance based on what I have accomplished already and the way I can find common ground to actually get the progress we're looking for.
Secretary Clinton, let's talk about health care. In the recent Democratic debate, you praised the Affordable Care Act, saying we finally have a path to universal health care. That's what Senator Sanders is talking about, too, universal health care. So what's the difference between your two positions?
Well, there's a very important difference. I do want to build on the Affordable Care Act. I think a lot of people remembered it was called Hillary Care before it was called Obamacare back in 93 and 94. And I fought so hard for universal health care because I think it's a great shame that we don't yet have it. And when we weren't successful, I turned around and worked for the Children's Health Insurance Program, which I helped to create, which now covers 8 million kids. So I know how challenging it's been for the Democrats who have championed universal health care to make progress since we first started back with Harry Truman. So when President Obama was able, with a Democratic Congress, to pass the Affordable Care Act, I was ecstatic. And it has provided a strong foundation to get us to universal care. We are now at 90%. I have proposed doing more to improve it. We've got to get costs down. We have to get more competition in the insurance market. We've got to cap prescription drug costs. But I think it would be a mistake if the Republicans were successful in repealing it, which they have continually tried to do, and what they would do if they get a Republican president. But I also think it would be a mistake to start all over again with a whole new system. And Senator Sanders introduced a plan, I think, nine times over 20 years. It never got a vote in the House. It never got a single sponsor in the Senate. He changed his approach in the last week, right before the last debate, and put out the description of a plan that would be kind of a single-payer plan and the like. It would be a great step back for us to go back to zero to try to get to 100% coverage rather than building on where we are with 90% coverage to get to 100% coverage. I know a little bit about how hard this is, and I think my approach is more likely to get the results that we both want, universal coverage, and I want it at an affordable cost.
So would your universal coverage be based on an Affordable Care Act model where there are private insurers and private companies involved, or would the ultimate goal, Secretary Clinton, be a Medicare for all, single-payer, government-run? I'm trying to figure out if you both support universal health care, what the difference really is.
Well, the difference is when you say universal health care, you want a system that covers everybody. we inherited a system that is based on private health insurance. I know better than most how hard it would be to change that system. That's why when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it built on what we had, the Medicare system, the Medicaid system, the private health insurance, employer-based system, because that is what people are comfortable with and familiar with. But we had a problem because you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. You're a young person and you're not making enough money to have health insurance. What are you going to do? You're a woman. You pay more for your health insurance than men do. That was what we had when the insurance industry got to call the shots. With the Affordable Care Act, we have made it possible for anyone with a pre-existing condition to get covered. That helps us move toward universal coverage. For young people up to the age of 26 to stay on their parents' policies, that helps. To make it clear that women can't be charged more than men, that helps. But now we want to take that foundation and go further. So it's not a single-payer system.
So it's still privately based.
Well, it's both private and public.
Right.
Because
Medicare
the Affordable Care Act,
sure.
I thought, you know, we debated this, President Obama and I, during right. the 08 election. What the Affordable Care Act does is to say Medicare, which is a single-payer system, we have to protect it. We have to be sure it's well-funded. We have to keep Medicaid, which is something that doesn't require any contribution from someone who is poor enough not to be able to afford it. But what about all the people in the middle who are working primarily but don't make enough money to afford or their employer doesn't offer? So the exchanges that were created by the Affordable Care Act come with subsidies from the federal government so that you put in a certain amount and then the federal government
right.
makes the additional contribution. That is now the system we have.
And costs are going up, though, Secretary Clinton.
Well,
as you know, people are concerned. They say, okay, coverage is there. That's great. But, boy, it's getting expensive. Premiums are up. Drug costs are up. Deductibles are up. And some Americans are saying, whoa, this isn't quite working out as well as we had hoped.
Well, let's talk about what is working, and then I'll answer the challenges we face. What is working is that we have now 90% of Americans covered. What is working is that 19 million Americans have gotten their health care through the Affordable Care Act. What is working is that we now have a system that can be fine-tuned and improved. We're not throwing the nation into a contentious debate to start all over again or having it repealed with nothing to replace it. And you have to fund the healthcare system from somewhere. So the combination of government and private funding is what the United States has built our healthcare system on. And I have said, look, we need to get out-of-pocket costs down. You mentioned deductibles. You mentioned premiums. I think we can do that. We have to get prescription drug costs capped. We have to have a special system to support families that face very large health care costs
sure,
and their medical
crisis,
bills go up.
Cancer or something.
Those are all doable.
How do you do the drug costs, Secretary Clinton?
Well,
I'm interested in that.
Right.
How do you cap the drug costs, for example? Drug companies are probably not going to want to give up their profits. So how do you
no fooling.
How do you approach them and say, look, you know, you used to get $5 for this pill, but now I, President Clinton, say it's only $4. How do you begin to do that?
Well, there are several things we have to do. First of all, the drug companies deserve a rate of return. They make investments, but they then charge Americans the highest drug prices in the world. And it really does make me crazy because we provide the funding for the National Institutes of Health. We provide the funding for the Food and Drug Administration. So we actually are partners with drug companies. Then they bring drugs to market, and they have to negotiate with Canada, with Europe, with Australia, other advanced economies, and not with us. So first and foremost, we have to give Medicare the authority to negotiate for lower prices and then bring that through the entire system. Secondly, we have to crack down on some of the predatory pricing that you referenced, because the idea is if you bring a breakthrough drug to market, you do get a a reasonable rate of return for a certain number of years. Then it becomes available for generics, and clearly the price should drop. What we're seeing is speculators, hedge fund guys, buying up drug companies and jacking up the prices for specific drugs. We've gotten some terrible examples of that. I will crack down on that. I think that's predatory pricing. I do not think that should be permitted. And I will also take away some of the tax benefits that the drug companies have enjoyed so that they actually put more money into research instead of TV advertising. So there are a number of ways that we will go after this.
You're listening to a special First in the Nation primary forum on the exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest today is Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, U.S. Senator, and First Lady. Also with us, a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. And let's go to our audience now. Thank you for being here. Please give us your name and ask your question.
Hi, my name's Heidi, and my question is, if the minimum wage is increased nationwide, what plan do you have to avoid the natural inflation that would take place if you did raise the minimum wage?
Heidi, thank you.
Heidi, thank you very much. I do favor raising the minimum wage because I think we can do it in a phased-in way that will be able to accommodate business, particularly small business. But I think we've got to raise it because right now people on the minimum wage, which, as you know, is $7.25 an hour at the federal level, some states and even some cities have raised it higher than that. But people who work full time are still in poverty. And 2/3 of minimum wage workers are women. And I've met some of these women. I mean, I have met home health care workers who go into our homes to take care of maybe elderly people who need extra help or people with disabilities. It is really hard work. They are lifting, they're feeding, they're bathing, they're keeping people company. And very often they make minimum wage or barely above. And at some point, we've got to start raising the wages of hardworking Americans to get the middle class back growing. It's been kind of stagnating because of the Great Recession. We're not back to where we need to be with wages going up and people feeling more confident. And I have recommended that we raise it at the federal level to $12 an hour, that we phase that in. And some of my opponents, and I don't disagree with this, have said they want to raise it to 15, but I think 12 would bring it back to the highest level it's been in real dollars since 1968. And it would give room for cities and states to raise it even higher, as New York has done, Los Angeles, Seattle, and some other places. So I'm a strong supporter of it. I will work really hard to get it done. And I think, as with other minimum wage increases that we've seen over the years, it will be absorbed into the economy. Inflation is very low for a lot of reasons. I do not personally believe that would be inflationary.
But so, Secretary, when you say 12, not 15, is that mainly to allow for regional differences economically or because 12 might be more politically feasible than 15 in your estimation?
Well, I really consulted with the principal expert in our country on the minimum wage, a Princeton economist by the name of Alan Krueger. He's been our go-to person to make the case that, contrary to some fears, raising the minimum wage does not result in job losses. It doesn't result in, you know, skewing the economy and toward inflation and more economic problems. But after studying it, he advised the Senate Democrats, led by Senator Patty Murray from Washington, that they should go for 12 with an inflation index to it. So you wouldn't have to keep voting for it, but that it could continue to increase. But it should be the floor, not the ceiling. So if you're in LA and you believe that you've got the economic power to go further, you should not be prohibited from doing that. So I listened carefully to that, and that's the position that I've advocated.
That's a big jump, Secretary Clinton, from the current minimum wage from $7.25 to $12. How long of an adjustment period would you allow? Because that is a big change, and
right.
Heidi's inflationary concerns are, you know, well taken.
Right. It would be over a number of years. We're not going to do it overnight. But I will reiterate that we cannot expect people who work full-time and often do the hardest physical jobs and often emotionally demanding jobs to support a family on $7.25, $8.25, $9. if you talk with the people who are doing this work, they're not asking for the sky, but they are asking for a little bit of help. And we need to get wages up for everybody.
More with Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in a moment. This is a First in the Nation primary forum on The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is here for another in our First in the Nation primary forums. We also have a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. And before we go back to our audience, Josh Rogers, I'd like to throw it back to you.
Okay, let's turn to guns. That's been a big topic in this race. You've said you were proud of President Obama's recent executive actions on guns. Would a President Clinton be pursuing laws or executive actions that would go beyond what President Obama has done?
Well, during this campaign, I've called for executive actions, and I was very pleased that the president rolled out a series of not only executive actions, but redefinitions within the existing law that would enable the federal government to do more to enforce background checks, for example. Look, I think we have a real crisis. We have an epidemic of gun violence, and maybe it's because I have met with the victims of gun violence for so many years now, going back to, you know, my years as First Lady, Columbine, for example, where you sit in a room with parents who've lost their children, and it's just totally overwhelming. And most recently, I met with a group of mothers who've lost their children to gun violence by police and by gangs and by, you know, other killings. So I've said, look, we have certain changes we could make because there are big majorities in our country supporting them. Comprehensive background checks, close the gun show loophole, close the online loophole, close what's called the Charleston loophole, which means at the end of 3 business days, whether or not they have finished your background check, you get the gun, which is what the killer in Charleston did. And he shouldn't have gotten it. And a day or so later, they determined he had a record and was prohibited from buying the gun. We need to end this immunity that was voted for. I voted against it. I've made a point of the comparison with Senator Sanders, who voted for it. But it gives absolute immunity from liability to only one industry in our entire country, gun makers and sellers. You don't get it from food. You don't get it from toys. You don't get it from cars. You get it only if you're in the gun business. And then, of course, I just find it absolutely unbelievable that the Republicans in Congress won't prohibit people who are on the no-fly list from buying guns. If you're too dangerous to fly, you are too dangerous to buy a gun. What I've just told you is supported by 92% of Americans and 85% of gun owners. This is a perfect example of a powerful interest, the gun lobby, intimidating elected officials into doing their bidding. And the only way we will change this is if enough people make it a voting issue. And that's what I'm asking voters to consider in this election.
Well, earlier this fall when you were campaigning in Keene, you made reference to sort of mustering a kind of alternative organization to the NRA. I mean, is that still a going thing for you?
I've talked about it a lot, and it will take some effort to try to get that done. But it's really encouraging to me because, look, I am in a lot of different crowds, and I've had a number of voters in New Hampshire and in Iowa come up to me and say, look, I'm a hunter or I'm a collector, but I think you're right. We don't need to be doing this. We lose on average 90 people a day, 33,000 a year to gun violence. So I'm hoping to plant that seed. As president, I would water it and I would, you know, fertilize it. I would try to make it happen because the NRA no longer represents responsible gun owners. They represent gun makers who are in it to sell as many guns based on fear and anxiety as they possibly can.
Well, there's the issue of guns that are being sold, new sales, and just the volume of guns that are out there. And one thing a voter asked you at that town hall in Keene was whether it would be worth looking at a buyback program. He referenced Australia, which was a mandatory buyback of semi-automatic and automatic weapons. I mean, are you willing to look at things like that? That's what you suggested in Keene.
Well, a lot of not a lot, but some communities have done voluntary buybacks, and I would certainly support that. But I'm right now staying focused on what we already have a consensus on. Let's try to get what everybody already agrees on passed. Let's get executive action that will send a clear message to sellers of guns that if you are selling more than one to your brother-in-law, you are in the gun business, and you therefore have to do a background check. Let's get the background checks to be what we had always hoped they would be. Make them more make them faster, make them more comprehensive. Let's do what we know people agree on, and then let's hope that we'll see some results from that. And I think we will.
I want to ask you about foreign policy, Secretary Clinton. Obviously, a field that you know something about as a former Secretary of State. The role of Russia specifically in Syria's civil war. Since Russia began the airstrikes in Syria, as you know, in support of President Assad, the anti-Assad forces have been hit hard, including those groups that the U.S. supports. If this Russian help continues and Assad hangs on to power, is that an outcome that a President Clinton would be willing to accept?
Well, let me tell you what I think right now, because I think one of the reasons why people need to take their vote so seriously is you are electing both a president and a commander-in-chief. And there are some problems we know the next president will face. Others we can't even predict. With respect to Syria, I think we need to be operating on two fronts at the same time. I've outlined what I would do about ISIS, the kind of efforts to use air power to take out their infrastructure, their leadership, and to support Arab and Kurdish fighters on the ground. I've also said we need to stop the foreign flow of fighters and money and take them on online, and then we have to take a hard look at how we defend ourselves here at home and cooperate with others. We're making some progress in the fight against ISIS. However, we know that the Assad regime continues to kill thousands of people. The last count is more than 250,000, 4 million refugees. And we have to have a diplomatic channel, something that I worked on when I was there, helped to hammer out an agreement, which actually is now at the center of the UN effort, which we got agreed to in Geneva in 2012. We have to keep pushing that, and I really support Secretary Kerry's efforts to do that. One of the reasons I have advocated a no-fly zone is because I want more leverage in dealing with the Russians.
In northern Syria.
In northern Syria. They've had two bad experiences from ISIS. They had a civilian airliner explode and ISIS take credit in the Sinai. They've had a fighter shot down when it's straight into Turkish airspace. So my view is we need some safe zones because the ongoing slaughter of people, now not just from Assad but also from ISIS, is just unimaginable. I think we are seeing one of the worst atrocities in modern history with what is happening in Syria. So we need to figure out how do we find safe places for people fleeing from Assad and fleeing from ISIS. How do we help people feel secure enough to stay and not become refugees, which causes its own challenges. And I think we've got to sit down with the Russians and make it very clear. At some point, we may have to institute a no-fly zone, and we are giving them fair notice. We would love for them to be part of it. Because their continuing support for Assad is not going to resolve the civil war. There will always be more foreign fighters, more terrorist groups who will come into Syria both to contest Assad and to claim territory for their own jihadist ambitions. And I think we've got to go right at Russia and make it very clear what the costs are for them to continue their behavior, which is decimating the Syrian fighters who are trying to protect civilians and take on both Assad and ISIS.
How important is it to you then, Secretary Clinton, or would it be as president, that Assad go? Because some people have said he must go. Other people have said we'd like him to go, but it's not our top priority. ISIS is our top priority.
Well, that's why I say you've got to do both at once. We will not be as successful with ISIS on the ground if we are not also in some kind of diplomatic, political channel discussing a possible transition. The agreement I negotiated called for a transition, It didn't say Assad must go, but it said that there had to be a unity government put into place to try to prepare for elections, to try to give the Syrian people a chance to pick their own leader, and that all sides could veto anybody going in, which was a way of saying clearly Assad would not be in that government. Now, this is very difficult because of Iranian and Russian interests in the Syrian context.
Strong interests.
But we have to keep working on it. When I put together the sanctions and put together the coalition against Iran, we didn't know we would get to an agreement to put a lid on their nuclear weapons. You start, you work, you adjust, you keep moving. That's what we've got to do on both fronts in Syria.
Well, I could ask you 10 more questions on this, but I'm going to turn it back to our audience. Again, this is The Exchange on NHPR. We're sitting down with Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. We've got an audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network, and let's go back to that audience now. Thank you for being here. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Christina. As a transitioning military family coming back into the civilian life, I would like to know what the Clinton administration would do to help veterans get back into the civilian sector.
Well, Christina, are you now out of the service or on the way to being out of the service?
My husband recently transitioned out of the Marines.
So he's out of the Marines.
Yes.
Okay. I think that's a really critical question, and I have some very strong feelings about it. First of all, I think we've got to do much more while you still are on active duty with both the, in your case, the Marine, your husband, and with the family to explore as many alternative options that might be available to you. I think that our military is an all-volunteer military, and it's a great gift that people like your husband give our country to serve, but it's also you are serving as well as part of the family. So I want to see a much greater effort to work with families to begin to explore options about what transition means, what kind of education and employment opportunities are out there. Secondly, we did pass, when I was in the Senate, a new GI Bill to enable the veterans of Iraq, Afghanistan, and those who have served in any capacity to continue their education. And I want to make sure that it is followed to the letter, and I will crack down on institutions who I think are taking advantage of our veterans. Too many veterans have reported to me that they've signed up for courses that really didn't deliver. And I am going to make clear that the Defense Department, the VA, the Education Department are going to monitor where those 9/11 dollars go so that you aren't making an investment and then a year later finding out it doesn't work. Thirdly, I think we need to use technology to have a great platform for all veterans and their families to access. There are a couple of good prototypes. A young former Marine captain, whom I know well, has started a website and a program called Hire Purpose, H-I-R-E, Purpose, and is soliciting, you know, job opportunities and openings and mentoring and the like. But I want to see that go nationwide. I want that to be something that you can go to not just now with the transition, but for years to come, because you're part of the, you know, the family of service members. And then finally, we've got to do more on jobs that are going to be made available. I had a program when I was senator from New York, which I really put a lot of time into supporting, called, you know, Helmets to Hard Hats, for people who came out, they had skills, they were looking for, you know, jobs in the trades or in other related kinds of occupations. But we need to have more employers understand the value of what people learn in the military. Sometimes, and we have to help our transitioning service members, sometimes the languages are a little bit at odds. What you've done in the military may not appear to an employer to be actually on point as to the kind of jobs they offer. But in fact, there are so many elements of that experience that should be really attractive to any employer. So we've got to do a better job of that. So those are some of my thoughts that I've worked on as a senator and that I will certainly give a high priority to as president.
Christina, thank you very much for the question. Josh, throwing it back to you, please.
Sure. Secretary Clinton, I want to move to another what's been a point of friction in this primary, which is the perception is that you're too closely tied to Wall Street and that because you've accepted hefty speaking fees from some investment firms that you know, that this makes you ill-equipped to deal with politics there. And just also to ask the question, how should the average person view this, the hefty speaking fees, essentially as nice work as you if you can get it, or, you know, as kind of, you know, evidence that the economy is, as you've said, rigged in favor of the powerful?
Well, look, I have a record of taking on Wall Street even when I was a senator from New York. And I take a backseat to nobody. I mean, I called them out on the mortgage crisis. I called to close the carried interest loophole. Back in 2006, I was sounding warnings about what was going on. And, of course, the Bush administration paid no attention because they were so anti-regulatory. And they basically let the financial institutions, the mortgage markets, just run to do whatever they chose to do without any interference. And I think it's fair to say that if you look at my plan, which I have put forth, it has been judged by very knowledgeable people like Paul Krugman at the New York Times as being tougher, more effective, and more comprehensive. Why? Because I go after the problems that we may face in the future. My, you know, opponent, Senator Sanders, I share his passion about never letting this happen again. And we now have, because of Dodd-Frank, the authority to break up the big banks if they pose a systemic risk to our economy. So that will be something I will watch closely. And if it appears, we will do it because no bank should be too big to fail and no executive too powerful to jail. But that does not really approach dealing with the problems that I think are now the ones we have to worry about. Remember, back in 2008, it was an investment bank firm, Lehman Brothers. It was a big insurance company, AIG. It was not just the big banks. There were all these other elements within the financial markets. We have to go after them. We have to go after the so-called shadow banking. And the final thing I would say about this, because I do find it sort of perversely flattering, is you now have Karl Rove running an ad in Iowa trying to convince Democrats to vote against me because of, quote, Wall Street. And you have two hedge fund billionaires with a super PAC running ads here in New Hampshire and Iowa making the same case. Now, I think a sensible voter will say, well, they're not running ads against Senator Sanders. They're running ads against the person they know understands how to take them on and get results. And I will do that.
Or because they see it as a political vulnerability. I mean, do you
ever? But that's because they don't want to run against me. Of course, they're going to try.
It could be for any number of reasons. I mean,
no, I don't buy that. I think.
But I mean, do you ever regret having taken these fees? I mean, it's become a headache, if nothing more.
Look, health groups. I spoke to auto dealers. I spoke to a wide array of groups who wanted to hear what I thought about the world coming off of my time as Secretary of State. I happen to think we need more conversation about what's going on in the world. I think groups that want to talk and ask questions and hear about that are actually trying to educate themselves because we're living in a really complicated world.
Secretary Clinton, it's hard to believe we have to wrap it up here.
Oh, my goodness.
Already, yes. We know you have yet another event to attend. You can't stay for our full hour. We thank you so much for giving us your time right now. We really appreciate it.
I have really enjoyed it, and I wish I could stay longer. Thank you all so much.
The Exchange continues in just a moment, so keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We just heard from Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. For the rest of the hour, we'll look at the race for the Democratic nomination overall in New Hampshire and beyond. In addition to NHPR's Josh Rogers, I'm joined now by political analyst Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. Dean's also author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura. Happy to be here.
Well, just broadly, first of all, your reaction to some of the comments we heard from Secretary Clinton.
Yeah, I thought it was a very substantive discussion. She's sort of well-schooled on policy. I thought it was interesting. She did not spend a lot of time talking about Bernie Sanders. She's been on the attack in recent weeks as the poll numbers have given her some concern. So I was surprised that she only mentioned him occasionally and focused a lot more on her vision in terms of fairly specific policy, both on health care, foreign policy with Syria, guns, and the other issues we talked about.
And Dean, just remind us where those polls do stand. Yeah. Josh mentioned it at the beginning of the hour, but when this race began, a year ago or 8 months ago, nobody thought that we would be at this point where we are now.
Even just a few months ago, if you go back to October, November, and even on into December, people thought that she basically had the race locked down. She had a couple of great debate performances in the fall. Bernie Sanders stumbled a bit on foreign policy. She had that highly rated testimony in front of Congress. So people thought it was pretty much a done deal. Now, the polls, there's a lot of variability in the polls. There are some polls that show Bernie Sanders ahead in both Iowa and New Hampshire and way ahead in New Hampshire. There are other polls that show Hillary Clinton slightly ahead in Iowa and not quite so far behind in New Hampshire. So I always suggest that people look at an average of the polls. But it's a real fight for these first two races for sure.
And just remind us of the history that may haunt the Clinton campaign from these early states, Iowa and New Hampshire, from her last race in 2008.
Yeah, in 2008. Iowa, Barack Obama had his big breakout moment in Iowa, winning the Iowa caucus. They came here, and Barack Obama was leading in the polls and expected to win in New Hampshire. She ended up pulling out that primary, and we ended up with a very long contest. And, perhaps we're looking at a long contest this time as well. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, Josh, almost every Democratic official here in the state, with some exceptions, but from U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen to Governor Hassan down to, mayors and city councils.
Hillary Clinton. Secretary Clinton.
Yeah.
And very few. And, that often is telling in terms of who's going to win a race. And we can see this on the Republican side, too. I mean, there are not that many people of prominence who have endorsed Donald Trump, who's leading in the polls there. Voters are restive, and I think that's been a challenge for Secretary Clinton. The next few weeks are going to be all about mobilizing supporters, doing what you can to make – differentiate yourself from your rival in a way that's going to motivate people ahead of the polls. I mean, it's interesting. Secretary Clinton at this event, she was off to a NARAL dinner, the Roe versus Wade anniversary. She was endorsed by the Planned Parenthood Action Fund last week. The women's vote is obviously very important to Democrats. And if you recall the last election in 2008 when she faced President Obama, that was something that her campaign went to in the closing moments to help solidify her support. It'll be interesting to see if that happens again. It's interesting because in both cases, Bernie Sanders and President Obama would say, they were staunchly pro-choice. The Clinton campaign did what it could to sow a little doubt. It'll be interesting to see if that happens again. But they both have a lot of staff in New Hampshire. They've both been working this hard. Certainly people on paper would say Clinton's team has sort of done this before, but it's hard to know this year. It's interesting. It's hard to see if there are any issues that develop over the next couple of weeks, or this is simply about moving your voters to the polls.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I think the big challenge for her at some level is connecting with voters emotionally. She's very well schooled on policy. She's running on a platform of experience, both, First Lady, U.S. Senator, Secretary of State. She's running as somebody who can get things done. If you listen to her talk in recent days. She's talked a lot about how, you know, Bernie Sanders is promising a lot of things, but the reality is he would not be able to deliver on those given the current situation in Washington with the Republican Congress and just sort of the political environment in the country in general. So, you know, sort of a kind of a proven, experienced policymaker, but a lot of voters are really looking for a sort of an emotional connection. They tend to be forward-looking. That's why I think President Obama was so successful in 2008 with Hope and Change. I think at some level, all successful presidential candidates run on a platform of change and you know, newness in the future. There is this also this sort of unusual level of anger in the electorate that Bernie Sanders has tapped into on the left, and certainly Donald Trump and to some extent Ted Cruz have tapped into on the right. And she kind of has to sort of figure out how to make those connections. It's a bit of a paradox because on the one hand, people often say she's not very good on the stump with public events and giving speeches. But if you ever watch her sort of meeting with people and engaging in retail politics, she seems to connect quite easily. So the key is to sort of how to take that and convey that at a much larger level, given the number of voters she's going to need to win.
Well, and I want to ask both of you about the other candidates in the Democratic field in a moment, too. But, Josh, one more question on this idea of, again, Hillary Clinton has basically all the top officials in New Hampshire sewed up, won New Hampshire last time around. What are you hearing from these top Clinton supporters about the real challenge that she faces from Bernie Sanders? What are they saying about how they feel about why this is happening?
Well, I think a lot of them were slow to see it coming. And you know, as an observer, I mean, I'll freely say that I didn't think that Bernie Sanders was going to be here when he got into the race.
They didn't take the challenge seriously.
Well, I don't think it's – I mean, she, you know, she said they always expected a tough race, and it is true that – Hillary Clinton's very popular with some Democrats. She's very unpopular with some Democrats. And, you know, you could put anybody up there. I mean, I don't know, you know, if Martin O'Malley were running alone, it would be interesting to see. I mean, obviously he was somebody who thought he was going to get in the race and could be somebody. I mean, obviously his candidacy hasn't really taken with many people. But, you know, it's not like she was going to get 100% of the Democratic vote. I think people are, you know, they're worried. They're worried. I mean, I do think after you get down the line, after you get out of New Hampshire and Iowa, you know, it's hard to suspend one's disbelief and think that, you know, Bernie Sanders is necessarily gonna flourish in the South. But I mean, he's done more than people have expected so far. And obviously, if he were to win Iowa and New Hampshire, that would be a blow to the Clinton campaign. I mean, we've got a long ways to go, and you know, you can't take polls too seriously. But the interesting thing about Clinton is that she's also, you know, it's one thing that makes her a very durable politician is that people, you know, she inspires a great deal of loyalty among some. She inspires a great deal of loathing among others. But, I mean, it's a challenge and it's a strength for her. How does she change one's perception of her? I mean, it's
especially since she's such a longtime figure.
She's so well known
on the stage.
You know, it's interesting to watch. I mean, as Dean said, you know, she can be good on the stump, and it'll be interesting to see how much time she spends there. I mean, it's anyone's ball game, and a lot of it's going to be, you know, again, it's who shows up to vote. I mean, it's a sort of a trite thing to say, but it's true. And obviously, both campaigns are working hard to make sure they get their people there, and you know, we'll see. It's going to be exciting.
Let's talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley.
Sure.
And Dean, to you first. So what about Martin O'Malley? Josh mentioned that he's struggling here in the Granite State. He's been trying to position himself as sort of, you know, while those two fight it out, I have real governor solutions since he was governor of Maryland. But he doesn't really seem to be catching fire. How come?
Yeah, it's not been working for him. You know, hard to say. You know, some people say it's just that the progressives, for whatever reason, early on, coalesced around Bernie Sanders as kind of a response to the Obama administration and to the Clinton campaign, and there just was no room for him. He's in a tough position. He's trying to remain optimistic, but you know, he's really been running for president for easily 4 years, 5 years. I remember talking about Martin O'Malley in 2011. In 2012, he gave that speech at the Democratic National Convention. Not a particularly strong speech, but clearly it was an initial attempt to get his name on the radar. So this is something he's been working towards for many years. And, you know, I heard him this morning saying that, you know, if he does well in Iowa, that will be a springboard here. And you know, you have to say that kind of stuff. But for whatever reason, it's just not it's just not happening for him. And, you know, maybe something to do with him as a candidate. It may have something to do with the people. It's much easier to focus on kind of a two-person dynamic. And the Clinton-Sanders dynamic seems to kind of cover all the bases of the various interested parties.
Establishment versus progressive and so forth.
Yep.
You know, we talk a lot, Dean, when we discuss the Republican field, which candidates are focusing more on Iowa, which candidates are focusing more on New Hampshire. There are some Republicans, you know, who are really just spending most of their time in the Granite State, and some who are almost spending all of their time in Iowa.
Right.
What about on the Democratic side? Are they pretty much dividing their time between both states?
It seems like it. Obviously, they're all with the caucus coming up in roughly a week. We're not going to see as much of them next week, and then they're all going to be here nonstop the week after. Martin O'Malley said this morning that he's focused more on Iowa right now because he's looking for a springboard. You know, I think Sanders and Clinton have been trying to do both. You know, there's a lot of gaming going on about what it would mean for, you know, what would it mean for Sanders to win Iowa and Clinton to lose. You know, would then New Hampshire be, would she sort of bounce back and be a comeback candidate in New Hampshire, or is Sanders going to win both? So I think they see both as critical. I think Hillary Clinton certainly wants to win Iowa, particularly given that she seems to, if you look at the polls on average, she seems to be in a little bit better shape there than she is here.
That's interesting. But I suppose that's the case.
Yeah, but I remember in 2008, the weekend before the primary, Obama was up 8-10 points in a lot of the polls, and we all thought he was going to win New Hampshire, and he ended up losing it. So,
I mean, another difference. I mean, the Republicans there are kind of cultural differences between Republicans in Iowa and Republicans in New Hampshire. It's they're more conservative in Iowa. It's a heavily evangelical population.
Yeah,
the differences between Democrats in Iowa and New Hampshire are not vast.
Not as stark as we see in Republicans.
Less complicated, right?
Sure. Well, and here in New Hampshire, some Clinton supporters, Josh, say, well, Bernie Sanders has the neighboring state advantage. How credible is that?
Well, I mean, there's probably some element. I mean, you look at people who've run from neighboring states, be they, you know, Paul Tsongas, John Kerry,
Mitt Romney,
Howard Dean.
Popular
yeah.
for a long time.
Mm-hmm. There is something to that, but if they're attributing it all to that, that's probably a mistake. I mean, I just think it's hard. It would have been hard for a lot of people to anticipate the lack of interest. And it's interesting, you go out and cover any of these campaigns, Republican or Democrat, and you only hear a couple of them, of Secretary Clinton to some extent, Governor Kasich. On the Republican side, you know, somewhat Governor Christie occasionally talk about, I mean, O'Malley's tried to, talking about deals they've made, you know, compromises they've reached, you know, the business of governing. And you certainly don't hear that from the people at the top of the Republican polls, which is basically sort of running against the status quo, or from Sanders. And, you know, sort of Clinton brand of kind of more transactional politics is something that I think that's one reason why it's been harder for her than she thought. That it's, you know, she said, came up here and said, well, you know, I'm going to listen to what the people want. And, you know, she says, I can do it. It's not simply about ideas. It's about the ability to, you know, shepherd something through. You know, maybe in the closing moments of a campaign, people say, well, do I really want to elect someone who might plausibly be able to get something done in a traditional fashion? Or, you know, when we had Senator Sanders here, he said that one thing he was disappointed in President Obama was that, you know, he built this movement and then kind of unplugged it once he got into office, at least in Senator Sanders' estimation. He was saying he really expects a movement. He, you know, talks in revolutionary terms. He, you know, really only joined the Democratic Party quite recently. So, the mood of the electorate on both sides is sort of a rejection of traditional politics. And I think that that's, you know, hard for somebody like Secretary Clinton to navigate.
To say that you're an artful practitioner at traditional politics at a time when people are looking for something different or new, or, you know, Bernie talking in revolutionary terms, and, you know, Trump at some level as well. It's just tough to get people excited about that.
Well, and I did want to ask you about that, Dean. So I'm glad you raised that point, Josh. We heard Secretary Clinton say just in our interview that we just finished, especially on the issue of health care. Sure, universal health care is great, but let's not, quote unquote, to use her words, tear it up and start all over again. So that's sort of the one prime example, Dean, of her saying, yes, but.
Right. And I think we've all talked, those of us have talked to Bernie about his agenda. You know, this is a constant issue for him, explaining how he gets some of this stuff through Congress. You know, maybe the Democrats will get the Senate back if they have a big election in November. They're not going to get the House back. It's very unlikely. You know, we get all the redistricting and gerrymandering. There's just going to be conservatives in the House of Representatives, regardless of whether you have a Democratic Republican president. They're not going to go for a lot of this stuff. So the question is, you know, given that, what would Sanders do? And his answer is, well, you know, we'll have a revolution. And, you know, he's been in Congress for a long time, so he understands it, how it works, and he can kind of come at it from the outside. And that's the thing people are going to have to decide, you know, whether they think that's a plausible explanation. Some people are not deterred by that. Others think it's a problem.
Well, and hard to believe, gentlemen, that we're already talking about Iowa not that far away, New Hampshire really not that far away, and then South Carolina and Nevada, Josh. How do things possibly shift in this Democratic field that we're looking at right now?
Well, I mean, the conventional thinking is that when this race goes south, it's going to be better for Hillary Clinton, that she has deep support within the largely African-American Democratic electorate in South Carolina, and that's going to be helpful, and that this and that Sanders, you know, has a lot of work to do to catch up there. I mean, you know, again, we'll see. Like, I haven't spent any time in South Carolina, but that's what people say. You know, people say he has been picking up a little ground as he gains prominence. But, you know, some of the things he said, I mean, the last debate in South Carolina, when he was essentially asked this question, and he was kind of like, well, you know, the African-American voter will, when they, like everyone else, start paying attention. And, you know, you could accept that two different ways. I mean, some people heard that as saying, well, it's a statement of fact. Other people heard it as potentially, you know, kind of a condescending statement to voters in South Carolina. I don't know how they would perceive that. But, you know, the conventional thinking is, when you go south, it's going to be better for Clinton.
How about Nevada, Dean? I'm less familiar with the political landscape there.
A bit of a question mark. You know, I think like Clinton has the potential to do well there. It is it's a caucus state. You know, Sanders' hope just is sort of generally with both Nevada and South Carolina is good old fashioned momentum. That if he wins Iowa and he wins New Hampshire, that has a fundamental impact about how people see him in terms of his viability, and then you're going to have this kind of what we call a bandwagon effect. So, you know, his argument is, yes, he's behind right now among African Americans. He doesn't have as much support in the South. That will all change if he wins the first two primaries. We'll see. We don't know.
All right. Well, Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at SNHU, and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And for this special First in the Nation primary forum, we'd also like to thank our audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. Thanks to everybody for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.